Well, last November, my brother and I were watching Peterborough United at home to Middlesbrough. Middlesbrough all over us. It was a bit like watching England play Italy. They were easily the better team, and they scored and threatened to run away with the game. Happened quite often last season, I have to tell you that. With about 20 minutes to go, my brother turned to me and said, "It'll be a miracle if we get anything from this game." Whereupon Peterborough broke away, scored, and somehow hung on for a very undeserved point. That made me think what a miracle is. So I looked in a dictionary. I haven't got an up-to-date dictionary. I've got a very old one that I had when I was about 16, which is many, many years ago. And it said, I think it's an Oxford dictionary, it's one, but it is ancient. It was gathering cobwebs, you know. Marvellous event due to some supernatural agency. I gave you a choice then of a remarkable occurrence. So I thought I'd ask some of you. And here's what you said, all anonymously, so nobody... A miracle is when something absolutely impossible in any natural sense takes place. Or a miracle is a supernatural event that takes place without human or natural involvement. A miracle is any event that seems to be so counter to the normal laws of nature that it is taken as evidence of God's intervention. I think a miracle is something that people think is impossible but is not. For example, babies might be a miracle for somebody. A supernatural interference with nature or the course of events. A surprising, unexpected, beneficial event which seems to have no physical, logical, or scientific explanation. A miracle is something that cannot be explained by science or reasoning, so must be a sign of God, e.g. when Jesus restored the sight of Bartimaeus. Then I thought about modern miracles today. One of you had given examples of the footballer Fabrice Muamba, who was dead for an hour or so, but he's still alive and well with no brain damage. Or the Chilean miners that were trapped underground and were all rescued and lived to tell the tale. I thought about Dunkirk, that at that time was seen to be a miracle, and there had been national days of prayer for the desperate situation that there was in those days. They said it would take a miracle for the Berlin Wall to come down, didn't they? People prayed for it, and it did. They said it was utterly impossible to consider Gerry Adams and Ian Paisley ever working together. And we heard the quote this last week when Martin McGuinness met the Queen of Ian Paisley saying, never, never, never. And now what have we had? We've had them working and actually praying together. You can't quite credit it. A miracle. There are everyday things now that to me are a miracle because I can't begin to understand them, like TV satellite broadcasts. You can get instantly from Antarctica or even outer space what's going on. Medical advances. When the king in 1901 had his appendix out, he was desperately ill for weeks and out of action for months. When my sister-in-law had her appendix out, she'd been into Bedford Hospital and out again over a weekend and I didn't even know. Telephones. I can talk to my brother in Edinburgh without raising my voice. Sometimes can. It's on the phone. And what about acorns growing into mighty oaks? Could you explain that to me? Perhaps these aren't miracles, but they're certainly marvellous. I mean, miracles are amazing. They're almost impossible. And certainly the ones in the Bible and the ones that we talk about change things and bring joy and happiness. I want to ask you a couple of questions, though. Does it matter if we do or don't understand? I mean, what Roger understands about computers and things and what I do, you know, I mean, what the cleverest scientist in the world understands and what we understand, you know, does it stop being a miracle because somebody in the world can understand it and explain it? Is a miracle what happens or how it happens? Or both. I mean, you read the Bible, you sort of You can explain Dunkirk with decisions on both sides. And I went to Bletchley Park with friends the other week, never been before, and you heard about the signals that they could decode then, so they knew, you know, what the Germans were going to do. But it was still a miracle. How could you get 330,000 British and French troops back across the Channel, you know, off the beaches? Anyway, what we're going to do now is explore the two miracles in our gospel reading. And I need some help, certainly from the children and the parents of children. You have to imagine that we're going to be a large crowd, and I need to switch on my bit of technology here, which is always extremely fraught. Green light has come on, so you should be hearing me now, yes? So if we could have the children, please, if we could have Jesus, we're going to have 5 scenes. And you have to imagine, as I say, there's an enormous crowd. Could you come make a couple more crowds? You don't have to say anything. There's a great thing you don't, and you actually don't have to do anything. You just stand. That would be nice. Welcome to St. Mark's, Jesus. He's playing the part. Now, scene one, if you could sort of gather around, you know, be a bit broadcaster. There is a large crowd. You know. Probably 100 people, I expect to say. Now, Jairus, the synagogue leader, comes and falls at Jesus' feet. If you think about it, the synagogue leader doing it, or you just imagine Charlie did that somewhere in Bedford, you know, people, well, you talk about it the next Sunday. And he says to Jesus, he looks up at Jesus and he says, "My daughter is dying." He's desperate. "My daughter is dying. Please come and put hands on her so she will." And despite all the crowd around him, Jesus nods and says, "Okay, I will come with you." That's scene one, the beginning of it. Okay. Now scene two, we're not going to move because the rehearsal last week of doing that was a total absolute disaster. So imagine we're walking along and the large crowd following Jesus. There is a woman here who's been suffering from bleeding for 12 years, and she comes up and touches Jesus' cloak very secretly. Then she disappears. She hides. She thinks that if she can just touch his cloak, she will be healed. And she is, right away. She is just touching his cloak. So the gospel account says. That's scene two. Scene three follows quite immediately. Jesus knows that an individual has touched her. He looks round and he says, "Who touched me?" And that is a stupid question. Because if you've ever been in a crowd anywhere, you know that anybody jostles against you. Yes, you know. Anybody jostles against you, could be anybody, lots of people, but he keeps looking round. He says, someone touched me. And the woman feels, well, she can't hide from it. She comes up. She is fearful and falls at Jesus' feet. She tells him she touched him. She's almost ashamed to tell him that she had touched him because, having had this bleeding for 12 years, she is unclean. And of course, having touched Jesus, you know, Jesus wasn't too keen on convention, so he didn't care two hoots about that sort of thing. It's very good not to care two hoots about rules and regulations sometimes, especially church rules and regulations. I shouldn't say that, because I'm in an Anglican church here. Baptists have never cared two hoots about official church regulations, you see. That's why we were called non-conformists. Because we were not allowed to worship in towns and villages because we were so terrible people. Some people think we still are. But anyway, that's by the by. The woman, you notice I've digressed there. Well, of course, so is Jesus. He's supposed to be on his way to heal, to stop this little girl dying, and he's taken all this time out.
because this woman needs his help. She comes up, she's fearful, falls at his feet, tells him she's touched him, and why? She says, look, Jesus, I reckon if I just touch your cloak, I'd be healed. And Jesus says, wonderful. Really, or words to that effect. Your faith has healed you. Go in peace for the rest of your life. You know, and she does. Her life has been totally and absolutely transformed. She doesn't have to go waste money on the doctors anymore. And she doesn't have to worry about being unclean. She's whole and restored. That's scene three. Wonderful. Scene four. Now, scene four, some men. Yes, come to Jesus. And we haven't got any men, have we, really, out here? So you imagine some men. Come on, any men. Well, all right. You come and you tell Jesus that actually his daughter is dead, and therefore you tell Jairus, sorry, where's Jairus? Jairus is in the air. Tell him that his daughter is dead. He's distraught. Jesus takes no notice at all. He said, he tells Jairus. He says to Jairus, don't be afraid. Just believe. I mean, that's something amazing to say to someone when they just heard their daughter's dead. Don't be afraid. Just believe. That's scene four. You got it? So scene five, because you all remember the reading. Scene five, we have here Jairus' daughter. Actually, if you better shut your eyes, it looks more convincing then. Because now, Jesus actually sends the crowd away. Sends the crowd away, takes three of his closest friends. He actually comes to a wailing crowd. Now, we better not do a wailing crowd. But it's these professional mourners. Like they used to be in Victorian times in this country. Like there is still in many parts of the world. Wailing, you know, because lots of people want to show public grief. It was, you know, it was what they did. And Jesus says, why all this crying and wailing? She isn't dead. She's just asleep. So Jesus actually goes in just with his parents, that's with Jairus, and a couple of close friends. He takes her by the hand, and he says, little girl, get up. And immediately she stands up. Now everybody around is convinced that she's dead. And she stands up and walks around, and everybody is astonished. Can you do astonished? But not sort of... Not sort of I've seen a ghost astonish, but really sort of this is absolutely wonderful astonish. Now that's the story. And if you've been there, if I'd been there and they'd been there, we wouldn't be sort of smiling and thinking it's lovely the children have taken part and everything else. I think we would have been absolutely staggered, gobsmacked. You know, we'd have thought, how wonderful, how does he do it? This has happened. Two people's lives and two families' lives have probably been totally, totally transformed. Absolutely turned. I haven't quite finished yet, but if you'd like to sit down, that's lovely. Thank you very much for your help.
Because you see, what those two miracles brought were healing to the lady with bleeding for 12 years, and new life. Jairus' daughter had dead and was alive. That's what Jesus did then for those people. And it's what he offers still today to everybody. He offers healing or wholeness. Getting to work on our contradictions and weaknesses and our strengths so that we can be at one with ourselves, at peace with ourselves, that we accept who we are. Most of us find that very difficult. We sort of feel we have to play a role and try and impress other people, whether it's family and friends. And then you have to behave differently to different members of families, because families are fairly tricky things. I shall discover that in the middle of this month when we have a complete ledger family gathering in York for a long weekend for my brother and sister-in-law's golden wedding anniversary. And that will be, well, family gatherings, as you know, are always totally sweetness and light. Hopefully it will be, because it's a happy occasion. But, you know, we have to be at peace with ourselves. What is it the hymn says? Take from our souls the strain and stress, and let our ordered lives confess the beauty of thy peace. If we can be at peace, if you like, with ourselves, we've got a fighting chance of the bigger miracle of accepting one another. It's a big ask, isn't it, to accept one another, whether it's in families or in churches or at work or clubs or whatever we belong to. But it can be potentially transforming at all scales of relationships. Perhaps if our negotiators and diplomats trying to cope with the situation in Syria at the moment, you know, if the Russians and Chinese and Mr. Haig and Hillary Clinton could somehow accept one another, that's as big a miracle, isn't it, as Gerry Adams and Ian Paisley. And that happened, so who knows, you see. But we Christians, within our church families, are supposed to be the prototype communities of love and acceptance. And we find it very hard, don't we? And if we do, we need to work at it. Because if we can't show there's a different way of relating, then we haven't got much to say to politicians, bankers and ordinary people who don't get on very well, have we? We're supposed to be like the prototype. And your prototypes usually fly if they're aircraft, don't they? They need a bit of tinkering, but eventually they might become something on a much bigger scale. So there's a thought and challenge and hope for us and our world. That's the wholeness. A new life, well, a fresh start, that's what Jairus' daughter has, in the love of God. And Jesus offers us a fresh start with the slate wiped clean. And of course that seems impossible, don't we? Doesn't it? Because most of us, having been alive for however many years we have, you have skeletons in the cupboards, things we've done, things we wish we hadn't done, all sort of carrying round with us. Can the slate really be wiped clean? And you used to try and kid boys that when they finished in July, you know, you can start with a fresh start, you know, in September. Oh, yes, wonderful, yes. 2 months away from school and they turn into angels and they become hardworking and everything else. Sometimes it happens, but it doesn't always, does it? But Jesus said, you see, I'm come that people might have life. Life in all its fullness, sort of real change, not something not to be feared, but to be embraced. That's hope for all. At Messy Church, we did the turning of water into wine as a metaphor for sort of the change in life, a bit like black and white to colour television. Wendy showed us a couple of wedding photographs of identical views, her and Chris getting married outside the church, black and white. And the same scene, colour, and there's no comparison. There isn't, is there, between black and white and colour? You know, you watch tennis or snooker or golf or anything, a play on colour television, it's wonderful. And now it's on HD. I've got HD. I've graduated to HD and a thin. I don't know how the thing works, but I have recorded a couple of episodes of Home and Away on it, and that works. But, you know, 'tis a new view, HD. Watching cricket, you can tell which way the ball's spinning and everything. It's almost beyond words, isn't it? You look at this tiny, thin screen, the television set. 2 centimetres thick. Remember the great thick ones with valves? This is this thing. And he's got all this electronic. I don't have to plug in a video to record something. You just press select and it comes up and it does it. I mean, it does it. Oh, it's when it goes wrong will be the problem. So, shan't have a clue. I'm following the manual very closely. All this is almost too wonderful to be true. Not just me having HD, isn't it? The wholeness and the fresh start is almost too wonderful to be. But as the hymn says, and yet I know it's true. God grant that we do. Amen.